Well, exactly. We did a hindsight study for Ann Taylor back this prior to the bankruptcy, so I think I can talk about it. They had closed a store in Chicago based on four-wall profit that was doing about $1.1 million in sales, and it was under their profit threshold. And we were asked to come validate whether that was a good decision or not. Well, it turned out they had 250,000 in e-commerce returns in that store.
Retail Unwrapped is a weekly podcast hosted by Robin Lewis and Shelley Cohan from The Robin Report. Each episode dives into the latest trends and developments in the retail industry. Join them as they discuss interesting topics and interview industry leaders, keeping you in the loop with everything retail.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining our weekly podcast. I'm Robin Lewis, founder and CEO of The Robin Report, along with my podcast partner, Shelley Cohan. Today, we really have the honor of welcoming Steve Morris, who's the founder of Asset Strategies Group, ASG. And by the way, a fun fact about Steve is that he has a passion for strategy games, whatever the heck that is. As many of you know, by the way, ASG acquired The Robin Report last year. And I got to say that already our brand has been really energized. And frankly, we've gained a great deal of value by being a part of the ASG and Shoot Gerdeman team. But today, we're going to be very focused on the topic of store profitability. And Steve has a wealth of experience in this field and has very strong views on how the industry should be measuring, quote-unquote, profitable stores, so store performance. So, Steve, welcome. We're glad to have you today with us.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Shelley, for having me part of this.
I think it'd be great if you could start out by giving our listeners some background about your experience before we discuss how retailers should be looking at store profitability. It really is not as cut and dry as it once was, and I know that, but you know a heck of a lot more than I do. So give us a little summary of your experience in this area.
Yeah, I'll be glad to. I started my career at Dayton Hudson, kind of a financial jack of all trades. I was, except for 2 years as head of corporate strategy, I was Mr. Fix-It. And when I left Dayton Hudson, I went on to about a 10-year career of other turnaround situations. Tonka Toys, where I was able to, along with the president, we acquired Sega, and I ended up launching as a product manager, essentially launching Sega in the U.S. Then I was treasurer at Norwest Bank, which was coming out of a bank loan crisis and a bit of a turnaround there. Then I went to Ames Department Store when it first went into bankruptcy. Then I teamed up with my old boss from Tonka, and I ended up running a computer game company in England for about 2 years, which was great fun. And so I enjoyed that. When I kind of rotated back to the U.S., I was looking for a CFO job in retail, and Limited called me and asked if I'd consider coming in to be fix their real estate, more or less. Yeah, they had 6,000 stores. They had occupancy costs have been escalating every single year. They were great at doing deals, and great at building stores, but not great at strategy. As a matter of fact, when I asked Les Wexner, how did he do, what was his strategy? And he said, my strategy, I just follow the department stores. They do all the research. So, of course, I'm thinking, well, why are you interviewing me? And then he said, that stopped working 5 years ago.
Got it.
And this was in 1996. He had bought the land for Easton, which has really changed the retail landscape, in 1991. So you could tell, all his pluses and minuses are less, but a great visionary.
Yep.
I did turn around the real estate at ASG. Limited Brands, we reduced occupancy cost 150 basis points, built a research group, a finance group, a lease administration, rent accounting group, a whole new technology package, and so on. And then I left and took some of those people with me to start ASG. One of those persons was Kerry Barkley, who's now the CEO of ASG.
Yeah.
So that's how we got started ASG. And we've since worked with probably 150 retailers. We have 60 active clients in a year. And we run the gamut of strategy, tenant rep, lease administration, store design, real estate technology, and so on. And I love it. You said strategy. Real estate is the ultimate strategy game. Incredibly complex. So this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart.
Well, Steve, you also wrote a book about real estate and leasing called The Secrets of Retail Real Estate, How Successful Retailers Win. And I have to also mention that there was an article written about you in the Columbus Dispatch newspaper that actually called you the retail wizard. So I've been called a retail warrior, but never made it to wizard status. And I have to mention one more fun fact about you, because I think it's relevant to this conversation today on store profitability, but you earned an MBA in finance at Harvard Business School.
Yeah, wow. You know, I think an MBA in finance from Harvard Business School can certainly put one on a path to wizardry. So Steve, in my opinion, for what it's worth, given the arc of your career, I think wizard fits. Quite impressive. But today, let's dig into our topic, store profitability, and you can share a lot of wizardry there as well. You know, historically, retailers talk about four-wall profit, you know, and that's been kind of a mainstay of retail accounting, right, for decades. So does it still give us the right answers in the 2020s? I mean, you know, we are now living in what I would say is really a new world. And there is a sense that e-commerce changes the very nature of brick-and-mortar retailing. And I can see that happening. Retailers spend hundreds of millions of dollars opening stores, and digitally native companies are told they need to become omnichannel, which means also open physical stores. So what do the accountants say? Are stores profitable?
Well, Robin, that's a good question. And we all know numbers matter. We're blessed in the United States to have the SEC, the Financial Accounting Boards, probably the best police, most effective reporting of real company results in the history of the world. But we are in kind of a world where here is what the numbers say versus here is what they mean.
Yep.
So we have to dig in a little bit on this. And first, I'll take you back in a little history. More than 100 years ago, 1916, Fred Lazarus, George Dayton, and Lincoln Filene came together. They were department store operators. They're namesake companies. They formed a little group called the Research Association. And then in 1921 or 1920, Fred Lazarus said, why don't we share our accounting records so we can do best practices just against each other? Mm. And that was the formation of AMC, Associated Merchandising Group or company. And I think most people know AMC. It was became the buying sourcing organization for over 30 department stores. But what they did back in 1920 was established a chart of accounts, if you will. And by that, for example, every retailer had the same numbering system. So if an account started with 4,000, it was an HR-related account. 4,010 was payroll, 4,020 was payroll taxes, 4,030 was medical benefits maybe, and so on. So it made it very easy to compare and contrast how you were doing. As a matter of fact, my first job at Hudson's, I tore apart the 30 department stores' expense structure in that granular wow. detail. Just to do a best practice, we're benchmarking. Where are we versus those competitors? And back then, we were all independent department stores in singular markets. No competition issues back then. Now, because these founding department stores were so influential, the CFOs, the CFO position across the industry came out of those department stores, Dayton, Hudson, Federated. Mm. And they took with them that chart of accounts. I'll give you an example. When I came to Limited Brands in 1996, we had 15 CFOs across our brands and functional areas, and seven of them had Dayton, Hudson backgrounds.
Yeah.
So those department stores had enormous influence. That chart of accounts, I should say, that goes way back to the 1920s, which didn't have IT in a chart of accounts, which became problematic later on, was that's what everyone adopted.
Well, yeah.
So in that chart of accounts, as you mentioned, there was a concept of four-wall profitability, and that was defined very narrowly. So a four-wall profitability was just the revenue of that store and the direct store expenses. So the store management, the store staff, the rent, the occupancy cost, and other kind of miscellaneous things like bags and boxes, credit card fees. So the four-wall profitability never accounted for all the other things it takes to operate a store fleet. Didn't allocate regional logistic management, yeah. didn't allocate warehouse and logistics expenses or any other overhead. So it was a very narrow view of store profitability. Does that make sense?
Well.
So when I was first came to Limited, we had, as I said, we had 6,000 stores. I could line them all up from top to bottom on four-wall yeah. profit. Yeah. And draw a line and say, here's 300 or 400 or 500 stores that have to go.
Yeah.
Because it was a very good comparative measure.
That's exactly what was happening when I was at Macy's West during that time. I was in store operations running logistics for about 85 stores in the late 90s. And every year we would look at store profitability and performance. And this is based on our four-wall profits. Yet, interestingly, we were measuring store manager performance on EBIT, which actually takes into account a broader set of numbers. And as you pointed out, I'm not so sure some of the numbers leading to EBIT were accurate in terms of allocating out marketing, distribution, or district management expenses. But at the time, making operating decisions about stores from a four-wall perspective was considered reasonable. You know, call out the poor performers, invest in better opportunities. But that was all before digital hit the industry in a major way. What happened when e-commerce changed the nature of physical retail?
Yeah, it's a pretty good question, and it was an enormous impact. I moderated a panel discussion in 2016, and I had senior financial executives from a number of retailers on the panel. And all anyone wanted to talk about in 2016 was Amazon. Yep. Amazon's going to kill us, going to change our model, do this and that. It was going to put us out of business. And we had a pretty good panel discussion. In many retailers, they had all started to adopt e-commerce. And in many retailers, the e-commerce executives were treated like royalty
yep.
because
yep.
their sales were growing very
right.
fast. They look great on paper, and the store operations executives were getting trashed, honestly. They were like negative sales, stalled growth, lower profitability. So it was a dilemma on these channel. Retailers weren't really thinking they were multi-channel. They were thinking they had e-commerce business, store business. One was profitable, one wasn't. Well, e-commerce was never really profitable, as Amazon has demonstrated. And it just created that conflict. The store operators had to take the returns from e-commerce. So returns were running 20 or 30% off of e-commerce. And that was a negative revenue on the store side. And then they had to process those returns. So they had additional labor. So, of course, their profitability looked worse. So I think that that was the issue I asked the panel about. I said, how do you measure store performance? And these were all smart gentlemen and one woman, and I'm expected to get a pretty good answer. And they all just looked at me and said, I don't know. It's kind of the end of the panel.
Unbelievable. You know, well, it just, Amazon changed the industry in so many obvious ways. But of course, that's just the beginning. And I distinctly remember Bezos' letter to the shareholders on day one, and that was back in March of 1997, where he said the company was focused on long-term growth and not short-term profits. And there you go. I mean, for 25 years, almost a quarter of a century, they didn't show making any money because they used all the money coming in to expand, and grow. Anyway, incredible.
Yeah, well, Amazon is in a category of its own. It just hit $575 billion for fiscal year 2023, up 12% from the previous year, and it's poised to hit over $600 billion in 2024. Many retailers have been trying to keep pace, but the one area, and Robin, you've written a lot about this, that Amazon has really failed on is its physical stores. I think the larger challenge for retailers that have physical presence is how can the digital side of the business actually drive store profitability?
Well, you know, I think everybody today acknowledges that when you open a store, you boost e-commerce sales. I mean, most of the digitally native companies have said their storefronts are their best customer acquisition tool. But you know, you also have e-commerce sales being returned to stores. And of course, Steve mentioned that a little bit ago. And that sounds like it is a negative sale at the store level. So how does all that impact the store profitability?
Well, exactly. We did a hindsight study for Ann Taylor back this prior to the bankruptcy, so I think I can talk about it. They had closed a store in Chicago based on four-wall profit that was doing about $1.1 million in sales, and it was under their profit threshold. And we were asked to come validate whether that was a good decision or not. Well, it turned out they had $250,000 in e-commerce returns in that store. So when you add that back, they were really $1.35 million. And then they had another, we did some customer analysis using their data. They had lost about $75,000 in e-commerce sales because of the store closing. So it was over $1.4 million store, and they should not have closed it. It left a big hole in the market.
Well, there you go. And by the way, that leads me to ask the same question. What is the best way for retailers to measure stores in today's complicated environment?
Well, the accounting, so-called four-wall P&L, won't give you the answer. Stores have trading boundaries, as we know, these amoeba-shaped, I think the Europeans are more eloquently call them catchment areas. Which is where the customer, the majority of the customers are coming from. So when you, in the old days, you could map a market, you could identify those catchment areas, trade area boundaries, and rank stores relative to the demographics and customer demographics within those boundaries and make one-off decisions, keep, close, open, reposition, and so on. But now with e-commerce, it's a significant portion of sales, 20 or 30% or more in some retailers. You may shop online, return to store, order in store, receive online, and so on. So optimizing stores is a different thing. E-commerce doesn't really have a boundary like a store does. So it crosses boundaries. So optimizing store open close decisions across these channels is just much more complicated. Now, the good news is, as always, the customers tell you. The bad news, it takes a lot of data. Yep. And some machine learning tools and some AI analytical techniques to kind of tease out the right answers. Now, almost all retailers have this wealth of customer data. Now, it's not uncommon we'll get 5 or 10 million customer records. If we use mobility data, you're talking about terabytes of data. Wow. So there's plenty of data out there to determine the customer demographic, psychographic segments. And with e-commerce playing now a significant portion of the sales, making one-off judgments on store performance by looking at four-wall just no longer valid. Or maybe I should say it's suboptimal.
Yeah.
For those people still doing it. Even trying to analytically modify a four-wall by attributing some e-commerce sales or e-commerce returns, adding back returns, really doesn't get you the right answer. We believe the better approach is looking at optimizing an entire market across all the channels of distribution. Mm-hmm. So the full price stores, the outlet stores, the wholesale points of distribution, and of course the e-commerce points of distribution. And when you model that using some AI tools, you get a much better picture of how to position stores in a market.
Well, this theory is sound, but maybe you can help our listeners understand kind of the real world application of this type of performance review.
Well, you know, we do portfolio strategy for a number of companies, and the one that just comes to mind when you ask that question is some work we did with GNC. They had, again, this pre-bankruptcy, so I feel fine to tell this story.
Yeah.
They had 4,500 stores, and they asked us to do their portfolio strategy. We did all the modeling, the transfer sales, the recapture sales, the transfer to e-commerce, the overlap between markets. And then we sat down market store by store, but within a market context. And we ended up recommending they close 1,000 stores. And we said, you'll save plus $10 million plus. And they did that, and they saved more than that to both profitability and inventory recapture. So it was a big, at the time, it was a big win for them. So I can tell you that market strategy approach works pretty
well.
Yeah,
that's very impressive, Steve. And I can see where that will make them very happy. But in your book, Secrets of Retail Real Estate, you describe the old school real estate committee process. Boy, I'll tell you that word committee. Anyway, which looks at a deal financial pro forma, and then someone on the committee asks, if you can knock rent down $2 or tighten up the capital budget to get a 2-year payback, and then the committee gives a thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I've been on capital committees at every size retailer up and down, and as finance people, that's what we're trained to do. It's to make these discrete decisions about, is a deal going to exceed its return on cost of capital, right?
Yeah.
I've just seen too many companies close too many stores to think that that's working for us,
yeah.
To put it bluntly. If I were a CFO today on a real estate committee, I would be asking these questions. What is the plan for the market? Show me a map. Show me my competitors. Show me what other deals are coming up, either renewals or other store opportunities that it could impact this deal. Give me a ranking based on your demographics, psychographics, your analytics, quality of location compared to other deal development opportunities. So doing stores one at a time in a real estate committee the way I described in the book is playing checkers. Doing a store plan based on market analytics is playing chess.
There you go. There you go.
I, for one, would rather play chess than checkers.
Yeah.
Well, the role of so many C-level jobs are different than they were 10, 20 years ago. And I would actually argue many of the C-suite jobs have changed dramatically even since 2020. We actually touched upon this in our podcast, How to Prevent the C-Suite Shuffle with Kevin Finnegan, who, by the way, I'm just going to say, Kevin thinks you walk on water, Steve, like literally. He said that your approach saved him tons of money when he was out running stores and responsible for hundreds, probably thousands of leases. But to kind of summarize for our listeners, stores really need to look at the entire market. And as you said, Steve, get a map and dig deep. This goes for retailers and wholesale brands too. And the second key takeaway is the customer data modeling.
Yeah. And a final comment, Steve. You know, with what seems like a pursuit of small store strategies among some of the largest players, Target and most recently Macy's, with your experience at L Brands, having, you know, management overview of some 6,000 stores when you were there, and obviously with your experience with many of your specialty retail branded clients, do you have a big picture piece of advice that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, I think I can help there. You know, while I cut my teeth at L Brands and with their 6,000 stores, and it was the king of mall
retail. It sure was.
My experience goes off mall, goes back to Dayton Hudson, to Ames Department Store and Target expansions. I've been a casual student of retail all my life. One interesting thing is in 1999, Les came to the real estate team and said he wanted us to open 500 Bath & Body stores. At the time, we had 800 Bath & Body stores, and we were in virtually every mall you could be in.
Yeah.
So how do you get another 500 stores? So we did tests, we did strategies, but we very quickly opened 500 stores. We opened power centers, grocery anchored centers, community centers, outlet centers, and we found great success with that. And today I think Bath & Body Works has 1,800 stores, and there's probably only 500 of those are mall, or what you would think of as traditional mall stores. So they're predominantly an off-mall retailer. You know, when most D2C retailers look to expand, their knee-jerk reaction is, I'm going to be off-mall.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to do a mall. And malls have a perception, and I think deservedly so, of being a mass market, undifferentiated shopping centers. And especially a lifestyle brand D2C company wants to be around, uniquely around their customers, which does mean neighborhood centers, specialty centers where the customers live. And they're generally correct about regional malls. We have data. We manage in our lease administration about 5,500 leases where we report sales, pay rents, and we have another large number of data points from our strategy work with different companies, and we classify malls. So there are about 100 what we classify as A or A-plus malls, and they perform above average. If the industry average across all real estate's around $350 a square foot, the A and A plus malls are above average, not to be ignored. When you get into the A, maybe average, maybe a little below average, when you get to B and C malls, way below average. So if you're just looking at sales per square foot, not rent, not landlord relationships, not negotiating with big REITs, which is part of the chess game, of course you should look off mall. You're going to get better productivity in some of these unique spaces. So I guess that's a smart thing. I'll go back to why that's happened. I think the strength of the enclosed regional mall was the department store's presence brought in traffic. So the specialty stores retailer didn't have to spend a dime on advertising beyond window displays. And as department stores closed and changed their model and failed to drive traffic into the malls, retailers started doing their own advertising. And then when you remember Gap started advertising back in 2005, I think. national TV advertising. And then when e-commerce came along, retailers were spending hundreds of millions of dollars each on social media trying to reach their customers. So you don't need the mall to drive your traffic. You're driving your own traffic. And so I think a lot of the e-commerce companies kind of intuitively know that if I can just find my customers and find a enough of them within a cohesive geography, I can be successful at retail. Yep. So that I think that's what's going
on.
You
know how to do that from your experience. I totally agree with you, Steve.
Yeah.
And Shelley knows this. I've been saying for a long time.
Well, you know, if you think back, I know you remember this because we talked about it, Robin. The Talbots started out as a catalog company, and they only opened stores off mall where they had a certain density of catalog customers. And in fact, I think Talbots started to go sideways when they started opening mall stores. But that's another story. Yep. So what's old is new again. You still have to look at customer data. You still have to find those pockets of customers and where they live and where people like them, who look like them live, and try and put your stores in those areas. So, but it's just not a cookie cutter world. You got to know customers. You got to know markets. You got to know centers, locations.
Yep.
And try things. Try the power center, the grocery anchored center, the community center, lifestyle center. You know, it's, I wouldn't say it's unpredictable, but it's, if you're a brand new brand, it's a good thing to do test and
learn. Well, I'll tell you, I think that's great advice, strategic advice, long-term advice for whoever out there is listening to this. And because I really, really, I believe it's the future. And so it is brand direct to consumer, and direct to consumer in many different ways. But anyway, I think.
Yeah, I want to go back to your question about Target and Macy's, because I really believe the operating strategy has to fit an operating model. So you can't be a dollar store and do a 40,000 square foot store, right? They have an operating model, a real estate model that are perfectly aligned. Target's operating model has always been these 100,000 plus square foot stores with big trade areas. They tried urban stores a few years ago, and it was kind of smaller urban stores, kind of disappointing. And there's just so much different about doing neighborhood stores or saying I'm going to pursue a neighborhood strategy. And they're just different in every way: merchandising, pricing, promotion, branding, logistics, supply chain, inventory breadth, assortment. That kind of innovation doesn't usually come from big established companies. I think of Old Navy created that model.
Yeah.
Well, I forget, in 2005? When
I
was
think
it?
So.
But they were the neighborhood family apparel store and extremely successful with their real estate strategy for a decade.
Well,
so I don't know that I've seen Target's new operating model that's going to make them successful in these smaller neighborhood locations, or Macy's. I'm not as familiar with Macy's, so I think I'll wait and see on that.
Yeah, I think we all will. But, Old Navy, we're getting off on a lot of different subjects here, but Old Navy early on was on fire. I mean, they were doing great. And, of course, I don't know, the whole Gap, Inc., all of those brands are in bad shape right now. Anyway, Steve, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. And, by the way, especially sharing your wizardly insights. Thank you so much. And, by the way, Shelley, we need to get, if anybody wants to contact Steve, right?
I'm on LinkedIn, pretty easy to find, and I'm at smorris@consultasg.com. I love meeting people and networking.
Thank you so much, Steve, for being here. For our listeners, you can find more of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and therobinreport.com. And please follow us on social media, link in with us for the latest thoughts about the industry.
Thank you for listening to Retail Unwrapped. We'll be back in 1 week with another podcast. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast service. If you have questions, ideas for a podcast, or anything else, please contact us via theRobinReport.com.